Good afternoon, and thank you for attending this session, Reproductive Rights and Justice. I'm Constance Jackson, your moderator, and a member of the Committee on Women's Rights. I'm going to go out on the limb a bit here and make an assumption that we all know in this room that reproductive freedom has been a worldwide problem and an issue for women for centuries, at least as long as we can remember. Advocating and setting policy for reproductive freedom is a fairly new phenomenon, spanning really just a few decades. I remember as state coordinator of public relations for the California National Organization for Women in the early 1980s, how much of a struggle it was to get national and state legislators to adopt policy that would protect women from structural and societal barriers that denied us the right to make a decision about our body, including access to abortion clinics. Still, in many parts of the world and in many states in the U.S., our reproductive freedoms are being systematically chipped away after decades of progress that was made. Fortunately, since the 1980s, there has been a surge of advocacy through grassroots and research efforts validating the negative impact denying access to reproductive freedom has had on women spiritually, physically, economically, emotionally, and its short reach into affecting the fabric of the home and community. So today, we have the honor of hearing from committed researchers who have made it their business to confront this problem head on in various ways that give us strategies and tools to effect change. I will read the bio of each speaker before their presentation, and we will anticipate questions at the after the last presenter. Our first speaker is Catherine DeAngelis, representing her research team that examined the cost-benefit of employing the LARC, or the long-acting reversible contraception, as a tool for family planning for women in Rhode Island. Katie is finishing her Master's of Public Health at Brown University this year, as part of a combined 5-year bachelor's master's program. Her focuses include health policy and cost effectiveness. She wrote her senior thesis on the implementation of nutrition standards in Rhode Island. She is now completing her master's in public health thesis on the implementation of health insurance marketplaces in New Hampshire. Please join me in welcoming Catherine DeAngelis.
Oh, can I open this?
Yes, you may.
Okay.
You're all set up.
Great. Thank you. Today, on behalf of my research team, I'd like to present findings of an economic analysis. We were asked by the Rhode Island Department of Health to conduct a business case for long-acting reversible contraception. I have no financial relationships to disclose. So before jumping into contraception, I just wanted to provide a little bit of context on unintended pregnancy. So contraception is inherently designed to prevent against unintended pregnancy. And by that, I include both mistimed and unwanted pregnancies, where mistimed is that the couple wanted to have a child, but a little bit later. So what does that look like in the United States? About half of all pregnancies in the United States are unintended. It's one of the highest rates of unintended pregnancy among developed countries. And the Guttmacher Institute estimates that by age 45, more than half of American women will have had at least one unintended pregnancy. Unintended pregnancy, which I'll probably just call UPs because it's a few syllables, are more concentrated among low-income women. While two-thirds of all births are publicly funded, only about a third of women are on public insurance. And UP rates are highest among among young women, emphasizing the need for early prevention. LARC, long-acting reversible contraception, IUDs and implants mostly. While LARC utilization is growing, that growth has been slower among young women and blacks compared to older women and whites. So there's both disparities in outcomes in unintended pregnancy and access and use of long-acting contraception, an effective form of preventing unintended pregnancy. There's a significant public health impact of UP. Women who have unintended pregnancies are more likely to engage in poor health behaviors during pregnancy, including smoking and drinking. These poor health behaviors lead to poor health outcomes for both the neonate and the mother. And DHHS has recognized this issue and has set a Healthy People 2020 goal to reduce the percent of unintended pregnancies to 44% of all pregnancies. So how much does unintended pregnancy cost? In 2006, it was estimated to cost $11.1 billion, including $4.6 billion in state funding. And these pie charts demonstrate that unintended pregnancies are disproportionately publicly funded. So there's a state interest to reduce unintended pregnancy, both from the moral perception and the economic perspective. About half of all unintended pregnancies are due to imperfect adherence. So that's where LARC really enters. So LARC, again, includes IUDs and implants. Although for the analysis I'm going to talk about, we only included IUDs. So this graph demonstrates that it's much harder to use an IUD incorrectly than it is to use the pill or the condom incorrectly. Other studies have shown that because there's a reduced reliance on the user, LARC is the most cost-effective contraceptive option. The California PAC study showed that for every $1 invested in long-acting contraception, they saved about $7, compared to for every $1 invested in the pill, they saved about $4. While we're seeing utilization of this effective method growing, utilization remains very low. Where does this fit in with health reform and more recent changes? Unintended pregnancy and contraception is a very relevant issue. The ACA really reflects this cultural shift to prevention. And as with private plans, Medicaid plans are now going to cover the 10 essential health benefits. Included in that, women will now have access to all FDA-approved contraceptive, including long-acting contraceptive, for no out-of-pocket cost. So you've probably heard that previously long-acting contraceptive was very cost prohibitive. So this barrier should have been largely eliminated. So we're expecting an increase in the number of women looking for contraception given this high publicity of contraceptive coverage. And additionally, more women looking for it because of Medicaid expansion in states where that's happening. So more women will be eligible for coverage. So hypothetically, LARC can offer a real win-win solution. It can decrease unintended pregnancy for women and potentially control state Medicaid costs. And other studies have shown that LARC is very cost-effective. Other studies have demonstrated what kind of impact, financial impact, increased LARC uptake could have at the national level. We chose to demonstrate potential cost savings to a state Medicaid program. And the reason we did this is because unintended pregnancies are disproportionately publicly funded, so there's more state interest. We chose to focus on the state of Rhode Island, because we were asked by the Department of Health in Rhode Island, to conduct this business case. As far as financing and numbers go, Rhode Island's fairly similar to the national average. About 20,000 births in Rhode Island in 2008, half of those were due to unintended pregnancy, and about 59% of those were publicly funded. So given the high number and high percentage of unintended pregnancy and publicly funded unintended pregnancies, there's both a high potential for savings at the state level and a high potential for the state to have an impact on reducing unintended pregnancies. So to demonstrate the economic impact of increased LARC uptake, we had to compare what was currently happening, what women were currently using for contraception, and compare that to a scenario where some women switched to LARC. So we identified three test scenarios. In the first, 10% of women switched from no method, which included both non-withdrawal and rhythm methods. 10% of women, sorry, switching to LARC. In the second scenario, 10% of women switching from short-acting, which we included the pill, condoms, injections, and the patch, switching to LARC. And then the third was kind of a hybrid method of 5% of each switching to LARC. So in the first phase, we compared the costs and potential savings that we could achieve if some women switched to LARC. Then we calculated a net savings and conducted a sensitivity analysis around that to see what variables influence our estimate of a net savings. And for those that phase of the analysis, we focused on one year time horizon. Whereas when we got to the three-year financial projections, we looked at what would happen, what potential savings we could accrue over 3 years. So that part of the analysis is a little different because we basically took the 10% of women that we were switching and spread it over 3 years. And I'll talk about that a little later. So the increase, or to estimate the amount of cost that increased LARC uptake would cost the state, it was the associated cost of contraception. So you'll remember that in our test scenarios, we're going to be switching some women to long-acting contraception, some women from short-acting, and some women from no method. Either way, Medicaid's amount of money Medicaid's spending on contraception is going to be different. So to get the cost of contraception, we included the product cost, the consultation cost, and the follow-up cost to get an overall cost of contraception. And then for each method, we annualized that. So to get the cost of contraception, we included the product cost, the consultation cost, and the follow-up cost, and multiply that by the number of women using each type of contraception so we could get an estimate of how much Medicaid's currently spending on contraception and how much they would be spending in our hypotheticals. And the range of the boxes here demonstrates high and low estimates of how much IUD costs. So what this shows is that in scenario 2 and 3, we actually spend less on contraception than we do in our current scenario. Scenario 1, we spend more on contraception because women were previously not using contraception, so there's going to be more costs. But the interesting thing is we spend less in scenario 2 and 3 because the annualized cost of long-acting contraception is actually cheaper than the annualized cost of short-acting. So the IUD Mirena, for example, costs $178 per year because it lasts for 5 years, whereas injections cost $392 per year because you need multiple of them per year. So while there's a real high upfront cost of LARC, it actually becomes much cheaper in the long run. Important to add that we didn't include the cost of adverse events when we were looking at costs because they're relatively rare and because other analyses have also excluded them. So to get our potential savings, our savings were coming from averting unintended pregnancies. And to get that, we had to multiply the number of unintended pregnancies that we could prevent by an average cost of unintended pregnancy. So to get the number of preventable unintended pregnancies, we looked at how many unintended pregnancies we would expect in our current scenario and compared that to a hypothetical. And because in each scenario we're switching some women to LARC, the number of unintended pregnancies we expect was always less in our hypothetical. The difference between those gave us the number of preventable unintended pregnancies. And in this step, we had to subtract out about half of unintended pregnancies because about half of unintended pregnancies result in an induced abortion, and Medicaid in Rhode Island does not cover abortion, so that cost is irrelevant from Medicaid's perspective. So we found that we could prevent between 84 and 368 pregnancies, unintended pregnancies. We could prevent the most in scenario 1, again, because women were previously on no method, so obviously it's going to be a lot more effective. The least in scenario 2, and then about 226 pregnancies in scenario 3. To figure out how much each pregnancy that we were preventing would cost, we looked at 3 potential birth outcomes. And we got those birth outcomes from the national analysis that uses similar methods. So we took a weighted cost of those 3 birth outcomes. And the weighted cost came from looking at the proportion of unintended pregnancies that result in that outcome and multiplying that by average Medicaid reimbursement. So by using the average Medicaid reimbursement, we were looking at how much Medicaid actually spends on the outcome and not how much a provider or hospital charges for the outcome. So when we added up those 3 potential birth outcomes, we got the overall average cost of unintended pregnancy. So once we had the average cost, we multiplied that by the number of preventable unintended pregnancies and got our potential savings. And so because we could have so many more preventable unintended pregnancies in scenario one, that is where the most cost savings comes in. We can save kind of middle-of-the-road savings in scenario three and obviously the least in scenario two. And the range here comes from, we looked at high and low estimates of Medicaid reimbursements for each of those birth outcomes. So top of the box is highest of all of them, and low, the bottom is the lowest of all of them. So then we calculated a net savings, which means we took the amount we expected to spend and subtracted that from the amount we expected to save. And you'll recall that when we calculated cost of contraception in two of our scenarios, it was actually cheaper to use contraception in scenario two and three, so we added that for total net savings. Each bar represents looking at high and low estimates of costs and savings. So again, the high and low estimate of costs was the cost of IUD, and the high and low estimate of savings was Medicaid reimbursements. And the gray bar is our base case or conservative estimate. So that's saying high cost, low savings, like what would be the worst case scenario. And so what this shows is that our estimate of net savings is sensitive to the percent of women that switch, the cost of IUD, and the cost of birth outcomes. But even though the numbers change a little bit, the overall story is pretty much the same. In scenario one, we have the highest potential net savings. Scenario two, the least. In scenario three, it's kind of middle of the road, 0.84 million. And that, again, is happening in 1 year if we switch 10% of women. So this phase is a slightly different analysis. So now we're saying that instead of expecting that 10% of women would change in the first year, 10% of women would change spread out over 3 years. So we said 2.5% would change in year one and two, and about 5% would change in year three, overall giving us about 10. And we did that because we talked to the Department of Health, and they said it was really not feasible to expect that 10% of women might move into this form of contraception in the first year, and that it might take some time to kind of warm people up. When we looked at this phase, we did use scenario three, where half of women were switching from short-acting and half of women were switching from no method. And we did that because, one, it seemed more reasonable to expect that a little bit of women from each would be switching, and two, because we wanted to make sure this option was going to be provided to every woman. Also in this step, we included a line for education and outreach under the assumption that some kind of effort to increase LARC uptake was going to require some education for providers and women. I'll talk about that a little later. So overall, we found that we could save close to $1 million over 3 years. $1 million is, it turns out, not very much of Rhode Island's $1.7 billion Medicaid budget. They actually spent about $1 billion on acute and pharmacy care, so that means $1 million is about 0.1%. But the Rhode Island Department of Health was pretty excited about the potential savings here and came at it from a perspective of efficiency is going to have to happen across the board, and this is one area we can obviously see some change. So in conclusion, kind of where does this fit in with reproductive rights and social justice? There are many barriers that impede efforts to increase LARC, this very effective form of contraception's uptake. In the past, out-of-pocket cost has been a really big barrier that should largely have been eliminated, hopefully. But other barriers definitely still exist. And a big one is misconceptions about safety. About 30% of providers are misinformed about the safety of IUDs. The Department of Health anecdotally reported that providers were very skeptical and therefore weren't counseling women on the whole range of contraception options. Women are even less likely than their providers to view IUDs as reversible, cost-effective, safe, and effective. In addition, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists last year came out and said that IUDs are now recommended first-line contraception, even for women that have never had children. So that was a policy shift. So I guess in conclusion, while we've eliminated cost as a barrier, the next step is really going to have to be focusing on addressing misconceptions about safety and disseminating these new clinical guidelines. And we think if we can do that, there's significant potential savings that can happen at the state level. I'll